Well, it has been quite the week, hasn't it? I know it has for me. Such monumental and exciting and important events in our life as a church here at Transfiguration coming out of General Convention. The most significant of which being, of course, our ability at last to experience marriage equality here in our own church. Given everything that has happened in this past week, just what an enormous and significant moment this is for us here at Transfiguration, it might have been nice if the readings had been, oh, I don't know, anything else. I would have taken, you know, Jesus talking about anything, love, mercy, peace, patience, you name it. Thanks to the randomness of the lectionary, that is not exactly what we got this morning. What we heard, instead, was the sad and strange tale of the execution of John the Baptizer. A story that, in my mind, seems to fit better in a Game of Thrones than the Gospel of our Lord. But the more I have sat with this story in the last several days, the more I have come to understand that it actually has quite a lot to say to us in this particular and remarkable moment we're living in here in our church. The story has, well, more than a bit of soap opera to it, and so it may help if I unpack the plot and a few of the characters just to help make sense of what it is that's going on. First, and perhaps importantly, the Herod that you hear in the story is probably not the Herod that you're thinking of. This is not the Herod of the nativity of Jesus. This is that Herod's son, Herod Antipas. Herod the Great had a bit of the same thing that afflicted George Foreman, you know, liking to name his children after himself. So he named, like all of his sons, Herod, and this son is named Herod Antipas. He was cut, unfortunately, from much of the same cloth as his father, Herod the Great. Herod Antipas was carrying on an affair with his brother Philip's wife, a woman named Herodias. And they did eventually marry, even though they technically never got quite around to divorcing their previous spouses. And it just so happens that Herodias was actually also Herod Antipas's niece. So there's a really nice ick factor to the whole thing. Well, if you know anything about John the Baptist, you know that he would have a lot to say to something like this. And he sure did, and none of it was good. And it earned the ire of Herodias, who would have been the most vulnerable one if Herod had ever been convinced by John the Baptist's railing against the situation, and if he had dismissed her, she would be the vulnerable one. So she jumped at this chance to eliminate her enemy, and to do so in a public and humiliating way. Like I said, it is a sad and strange story for the Gospel or Mark to choose to insert into the midst of the Gospel of Jesus. And as I've been pondering it, I keep coming back to the way that Herod weakly acquiesces to Herodias' vengeful request. The way Mark tells this story, it seems like Herod does it going against his better judgment. Like he actually knows, realizes in the moment that it's a mistake. Mark even makes a point to say that Herod feared John, knowing that he was a righteous and holy man, that he had actually protected him. And yet here he is, consenting to John's brutal death. Because, and here's the important part, because he would rather save face in the court of public opinion than to admit that he had made a rash and foolish promise. He knows that it's wrong, but he would rather go ahead instead of admitting that he'd made a mistake. So I wonder, does that sound at all familiar to you? Have you ever chosen to save face instead of admitting that you've made a mistake? Have you ever gone ahead and done something, something that you knew was probably going to have negative consequences, something that you almost began to regret even as you were doing it, but you didn't stop because you didn't want to admit that you were wrong. I know this sounds awfully familiar to me. It sounds to me like those moments when I make a mistake in front of my kids or my wife, which I then immediately try to excuse or explain away rather than just admitting that I screwed up, apologizing, you know. It sounds to me an awful lot like those moments when we can be at work and a project that we were working on didn't go the way that we had hoped, it didn't go well at all. But rather than admit your own involvement in the project's failure, rather than admit that you have some culpability in the way that it all went down, instead you look around for someone to blame and you find a coworker or a boss, anyone who you can lobby that blame on. It sounds to me an awful lot like those moments that we can face when we're standing with somebody and they tell a tasteless or inappropriate joke or tell a story and we all stand there and we laugh at it just to go along because we don't want to make waves or cause a scene by saying how inappropriate it is. It sounds a lot to me like our current political environment, where no one ever makes a mistake, obviously. No one ever admits that they screwed up or were just wrong about something. And as long as an alleged wrongdoer is in your own party, as long as they're on your team, well, then there's actually no such thing as a mistake. People in our own party don't make mistakes. So often, we are more committed to our pride, to our sense of being right, than we are to the total and eventual outcome being a good one. So often, our instinct for self-preservation and the positive opinion of others prevents us from doing what we know to be the right thing. So we double down on our pride. We double down on our sense of rightness. And we fail to do the right thing because doing the right thing in that moment might actually cost something. Now, admittedly, for us, unlike Herod, our selfishness in these moments doesn't usually lead to the death of innocent people. But that doesn't mean we're still not being disobedient to the way of Jesus, to living in his way of truth and love and mercy. The bottom line is that most of us do not admit that we're wrong often enough. Not long ago, someone asked me for the best piece of advice I had ever received. It was easy, really. Long ago, someone said, "You can be right or you can be in relationship." The best piece of advice I've ever received. It was given to me in anticipation of getting married. This friend called it advice for the secret of a healthy marriage. You can be right or you can be in relationship. Our world has so successfully conditioned most of us to be zero-sum soldiers. To think that if we're right, which obviously we're always right, well, then the other person then must be wrong. And it's our job, naturally, because they're wrong, to show that to them, because they need us to tell that to them. This attitude is at the heart of so very many Facebook exchanges. Have you noticed that? But from my experience as a pastor, I can honestly say that marriages between people who spend all their time in this simmering stew of aggravation and competition aren't happy, and they usually don't last very long. But it's not just married people who could stand to hear this piece of advice that I received long ago. Quite often, the mature thing, the loving thing, what I would even call the Christian thing to do, is to set aside the certainty of our rightness in order to hold on to relationship with someone else. We don't have to treat every conversation as though it is a debate or a competition that we are trying to win. Just like marriages, friendships don't usually last very long if there are always winners and losers. Because the truth is that if we're always trying to save face instead of admitting that we're wrong, well, then someone's head usually winds up on a platter. There's a high cost to all of our need to be right all the time. So much goodness and mercy would be made manifest in our world if Christians would simply remember that all of our zealousness to always be right isn't doing a whole lot of good, shaping the world more nearly into the kingdom of God. I am deeply thankful that the Episcopal Church lived out a bit of this wisdom this past week. General Convention passed a beautiful compromise, a compromise resolution that will finally allow, enable Transfiguration and parishes just like us in the wider Episcopal Church to host the marriages of all of our members. We have long, too long, been bound by the need of some in our church to be absolutely and exclusively right. Well, come this Advent, marriage will finally and at last simply be marriage for all of our members here. Can you believe it? And the reason for this achievement is that the Episcopal Church figured out how to hold different people together, how to maintain relationship, rather than simply continue to be held captive by those who believe that they are the only truly faithful Christians in our church. But here's the thing. It will be tempting in coming days for us to fall into Herod's trap, to let our certainty of our rightness blind us to our own need to be in relationship. It will be tempting to want to save face after all of our years of hurt and frustration, to lambast those who have opposed us in this effort. But my friends, if we line up behind our pride and our self-righteousness, if we simply lob verbal hand grenades at others who are not sharing in our joy at this moment, we will not be modeling the way of Jesus to anyone, and least of all to each other. The wider world assumes that there are always winners and losers. And we, you and I, this church, we will be utterly and completely indistinguishable from that wider world if we live into that belief too, that there always have to be winners and losers. Because you see, the way of Jesus is bigger. It's more merciful. It's more hopeful than a competition. We don't have to worry so much about always saving face. We don't have to worry about always winning. We can be part of stopping the cycle that seems to always result in heads on platters. So tomorrow, and next week, and next month, and in all the days to come, we can be right, or we can be in relationship with one another, with our spouses, with our kids, with our co-workers and with our neighbors, with our friends and with the people we just call friends on Facebook, with our bishop, with our diocese. Let's choose the way of love, the way of relationship. Let's choose the way of Jesus. And all of God's people said,